The Wahhabis first came to Central Asia in 1912, when a native of Medina, Sayed Shari Muhammad, set up Wahhabi cells in Tashkent and the Fergana Valley. From here, and from British India, the creed travelled to Afghanistan, where it had minuscule support before the war. However, as Saudi arms and money flowed to Saudi-trained Wahhabi leaders among the Pashtuns, a small following emerged. In the early stages of the war, the Saudis sent an Afghan long settled in Saudi Arabia, Abdul Razul Sayaf, to set up a Wahhabi party, the Ittihad-e-Islami, Islamic Unity, in Peshawar. The Wahhabi Afghans, who were also called Salafis, became active opponents of both the Sufi and the traditional tribal-based parties, but they were unable to spread their message because they were immensely disliked by ordinary Afghans who considered it a foreign creed. Arab Mujahideen, including Osama bin Laden, who joined the jihad, won a small Pashtun following, largely due to the lavish funds and weapons at their disposal. Thanks to the CIA-ISI arms pipeline, the engine of the jihad was the radical Islamic parties. Hikmetyar and Massoud had both participated in an unsuccessful uprising against President Mohammed Daoud in 1975. These Islamic radicals had then fled to Pakistan, where they were patronised by Islamabad as a means to pressure future Afghan governments. Thus, when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan in 1979, Pakistan already had effective Islamic radicals under its control, which could lead the jihad. President Zia-ul-Haq insisted that the bulk of CIA military aid was transferred to these parties, until Massoud became independent and fiercely critical of Pakistani control. These Islamic leaders were drawn from a new class of educated university students. Hikmetyar studied engineering at Kabul University, Massoud studied at Kabul's French Lycée, who took their inspiration from the most radical and politicised Islamic party in Pakistan, the Jamaat-e-Islami. The Pakistani Jamaat, in turn, was inspired by the Ikhwan-ul-Muslimin, or the Muslim Brotherhood, which was set up in Egypt in 1928 with the aim of bringing about an Islamic revolution and creating an Islamic state. The founder of the Ikhwan, Hassan al-Banna, 1906 to 1949, was a major influence on Abdul Allah Maududi, 1903 to 1978, who founded the Pakistani Jamaat in 1941. The old Ikhwan movements around the Muslim world wanted an Islamic revolution rather than a nationalist or communist revolution to overthrow colonialism. In opposition to the traditional mullahs, these Islamicists refused to compromise with the indigenous neo-colonial elite and wanted radical political change which would create a true Islamic society as constituted by the Prophet Muhammad in Mecca and Medina, as well as deal with the challenges of the modern world. They rejected nationalism, ethnicity, tribal segmentation and feudal class structures in favour of a new Muslim internationalism, which would reunite the Muslim world, or Ummah. To achieve this, parties like the Pakistani Jamaat and Hikmetyar's Hizb-e-Islami set up highly centralised modern parties organised along communist lines with a cell system, extreme secrecy, political indoctrination and military training. The greatest weakness of the Ikhwan model of political Islam is its dependence on a single charismatic leader, an amir, rather than a more democratically constituted organisation to lead it. The obsession of radical Islam is not the creation of institutions, but the character and purity of its leader, his virtues and qualifications, and whether his personality can emulate the personality of the Prophet Muhammad. Thus, these movements presuppose the Islamic virtue of individuals, even though such virtue can only be logically acquired if a society is already truly Islamic. Invariably, as was the case with Hikmetyar, this model allowed dictatorship to flourish. Nevertheless, these radical Islamicists, as compared to the Taliban, were relatively modern and forward-looking. They favoured women's education and participation in social life. They developed, or tried to develop, theories for an Islamic economy, banking system, foreign relations, and a more equitable and just social system. However, the radical Islamicist discourse suffered from the same weakness and limitations as the Afghan Marxist did, As an all-inclusive ideology, they rejected rather than integrated the vastly different social, religious and ethnic identities that constituted Afghan society. Both the Afghan communists and Islamicists wanted to impose radical change on a traditional social structure by a revolution from the top. They wished to do away with tribalism and ethnicity by fiat, an impossible task, and were unwilling to accept the complex realities on the ground. The Afghan Islamicists' political failure and their inability to produce reality-based theories of change is a widespread phenomenon in the Muslim world. The French scholar Olivier Roy has dubbed it the failure of political Islam. Muslim societies in the 20th century have been divided between two contradictory structures: the clan, tribe and ethnic group on one hand, and the state and religion on the other. It is the small group versus the larger faith, or the tribe versus the ummah, which has been the main focus of loyalty and commitment, rather than the state. Afghanistan's Islamicists failed to resolve this dichotomy. The Taliban had set out as an Islamic reform movement. Throughout Muslim history, Islamic reform movements have transformed both the nature of belief and political and social life, as Muslim nomadic tribes destroyed other Muslim empires, transformed them, and then were themselves urbanized and later destroyed. This political change has always been made possible through the concept of jihad. Western thought, heavily influenced by the medieval Christian Crusades, has always portrayed jihad as an Islamic war against unbelievers. But essentially, jihad is the inner struggle of a Muslim to become a better human being, improve himself, and help his community. Jihad is also a testing ground for obedience to God and implementing his commands on earth. Jihad is the inner struggle of moral discipline and commitment to Islam and political action. Islam also sanctions rebellion against an unjust ruler, whether Muslim or not, and jihad is the mobilizing mechanism to achieve change. Thus, the life of the Prophet Muhammad has become the jihadi model of impeccable Muslim behavior and political change, as the Prophet himself rebelled with deep religious and moral anger against the corrupt Arab society he was living in. The Taliban were thus acting in the spirit of the Prophet's jihad when they attacked the rapacious warlords around them. Yet jihad does not sanction the killing of fellow Muslims on the basis of ethnicity or sect, and it is this, the Taliban interpretation of jihad, which appalls the non-Pashtuns. While the Taliban claim they're fighting a jihad against corrupt, evil Muslims, the ethnic minorities see them as using Islam as a cover to exterminate non-Pashtuns. The Taliban interpretation of Islam, jihad and social transformation was an anomaly in Afghanistan because the movement's rise echoed none of the leading Islamicist trends that had emerged through the anti-Soviet war. The Taliban were neither radical Islamicists inspired by the Ikhwan, nor mystical Sufis, nor traditionalists. They fitted nowhere in the Islamic spectrum of ideas and movements that had emerged in Afghanistan between 1979 and 1994. It could be said that the degeneration and collapse of legitimacy of all three trends, radical Islamicism, Sufism and traditionalism, into a naked, rapacious power struggle, created the ideological vacuum which the Taliban were to fill. The Taliban represented nobody but themselves, and they recognized no Islam except their own. But they did have an ideological base, an extreme form of Deobandism, which was being preached by Pakistani Islamic parties in Afghan refugee camps in Pakistan. The Deobandis, a branch of Sunni Hanafi Islam, has had a history in Afghanistan, but the Taliban's interpretation of the creed has no parallel anywhere in the Muslim world. The Deobandis arose in British India, not as a reactionary but a forward-looking movement that would reform and unite Muslim society as it struggled to live within the confines of a colonial state ruled by non-Muslims. Its main ideologues were Mohammad Qasim Nanatawi, 1833-77, and Rashid Ahmed Gangohi, 1829-1905, who founded the first madrasa in Deoband near New Delhi. The Indian Mutiny of 1857 was a watershed for Indian Muslims who had led the anti-British revolt and had been severely defeated. In the aftermath of the mutiny, several philosophical and religious trends emerged amongst Indian Muslims in a bid to revive their standing. They ranged from the Deobandis to pro-Western reformers who set up colleges such as the Aligarh Muslim University, based on the British model, which would teach Islam and the liberal arts and sciences, so Muslim youth could catch up with their British rulers and compete with the growing Hindu elite. All these reformers saw education as the key to creating a new modern Muslim. The Deobandis aimed to train a new generation of learned Muslims who would revive Islamic values based on intellectual learning, spiritual experience, Sharia law, and tariqa, or the path. By teaching their students how to interpret Sharia, they aimed to harmonize the classical Sharia texts with current realities. The Deobandis took a restrictive view of the role of women, opposed all forms of hierarchy in the Muslim community, and rejected the Shia. But the Taliban were to take these beliefs to an extreme which the original Deobandis would never have recognized. The Deobandis set up madrasas all over India, and Afghan students, themselves searching for a better understanding of how Islam could cope with colonialism, arrived to study. By 1879, there were 12 Deobandi madrasas across India, and Afghan students were plentiful, although they were described as rowdy and quick-tempered. By 1967, when Deoband celebrated its first centenary, there were 9,000 Deobandi madrasas across South Asia. In the early 20th century, the Afghan government sought cooperation with Deoband to expand its own attempt to build modern, state-controlled madrasas. Ulema from the Deoband Madrasa visited Kabul in 1933 for King Zahir Shah's coronation and said the Deoband would prepare such ulema in the changed circumstances of the period that they may cooperate fully with the aim and purpose of the free governments in the world of Islam and prove sincere workers for the state. A few Deobandi madrasas were established by the Afghan state, but they were not hugely popular even in the Pashtun belt. Deobandi madrasas developed much faster in Pakistan after its creation in 1947. The Deobandis set up the JUI, a purely religious movement, to propagate their beliefs and mobilize the community of believers. In 1962, its leader in the Northwest Frontier Province, Maulana Ghulam Ghaus Hazarvi, turned the JUI into a political party, as a result of which it quickly split into several factions. Maulana Mufti Mahmood, a dynamic leader, took over the Pashtun faction of the JUI in the Northwest Frontier Province and remoulded it in a populist form. Mufti Mahmood's JUI played a leading role in the 1970 elections, mobilizing support against military rule. He propagated a 22-point Islamic agenda, which included a progressive social program and a strong anti-American, anti-imperialist stance. The JUI campaign was marked by a bitter feud with the Jamaat-e-Islami, and the rift between the two largest Islamic parties persists to this day. The history of the JUI in Pakistan is not relevant here, but the Deobandi creed was to become the primary religious and ideological influence on the Taliban. During the 1980s, Pakistan's Afghan policy was conducted with the help of the Jamaat-e-Islami and Hikmetyar's Hizb-e-Islami, who were also the main rivals of the JUI inside Pakistan. The ISI's connection with the Jamaat-e-Islami was an important policy instrument in the distribution of aid to the Mujahideen. The JUI, which was now run by Mufti Mahmood's son, Maulana Fazlur Rahman, was given no political role, and the small pro-Deobandi Afghan Mujahideen groups were largely ignored. However, the JUI used this period to set up hundreds of madrasas along the Pashtun belt in the Northwest Frontier Province and Baluchistan, where it offered young Pakistanis and Afghan refugees the chance of a free education, food, shelter, and military training. These madrasas were to train a new generation of Afghans for the post-Soviet period. Even though the Deobandis received no political support, the military regime of President Zia-ul-Haq funded madrasas of all sectarian persuasions. In 1971, there were only 900 madrasas in Pakistan. But by the end of the Zia era, in 1988, there were 8,000 madrasas and 25,000 unregistered ones, educating over 500,000 students. As Pakistan's state-run educational system steadily collapsed, these madrasas became the only avenue for boys from poor families to receive the semblance of an education. Most of these madrasas were in rural areas and Afghan refugee camps, and were run by semi-educated mullahs who were far removed from the original reformist agenda of the Deobandi school. Their interpretation of Sharia was heavily influenced by Pashtunwali, the tribal code of the Pashtuns, while funds from Saudi Arabia to madrasas and parties which were sympathetic to the Wahhabi creed, as the Deobandis were, helped these madrasas turn out young militants who were deeply cynical of those who had fought the jihad against the Soviets. After the 1992 capture of Kabul by the Mujahideen, the ISI continued to ignore the JUI's growing influence over the southern Pashtuns. The JUI was politically isolated at home, remaining in opposition to the first Benazir Bhutto government, 1988-90, and the first Nawaz Sharif government, 1990-93. However, in the 1993 elections, the JUI allied itself with the winning Pakistan People's Party, the PPP, led by Benazir Bhutto, thus becoming a part of the ruling coalition. The JUI's access to the corridors of power for the first time allowed it to establish close links with the army, the ISI and the Interior Ministry under retired General Nasirullah Babur. Babur was in search of a new Pashtun group which could revive Pashtun fortunes in Afghanistan and give access to Pakistani trade with Central Asia through southern Afghanistan, and the JUI offered him that opportunity. The JUI leader, Maulana Fazlur Rahman, was made chairman of the National Assembly Standing Committee for Foreign Affairs, a position that enabled him to have influence on foreign policy for the first time. He was to use his position to visit Washington and European capitals to lobby for the Taliban and Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states to enlist their financial support. With no centralized hierarchy, nor the ability of any locally renowned or learned mullah to start a madrasa, the Deobandi tradition resulted in dozens of breakaway extremist factions emerging out of the mainstream JUI. The most important breakaway faction of the JUI is led by Maulana Samiul Haq, a religious and political leader who has been a member of the National Assembly and a senator, and whose madrasa became a major training ground for the Taliban leadership. In 1999, at least 8 Taliban cabinet ministers in Kabul were graduates of Haq's Darul Uloom Haqqaniya, and dozens more graduates served as Taliban governors in the provinces, military commanders, judges and bureaucrats. Yunis Khalis and Muhammad Nabi Mohammedi, leaders of the traditional Mujahideen parties, both studied at Haqqaniya. Haqqaniya is in Akhora Katak in the northwest frontier province. It is a sprawling collection of buildings on the main Islamabad-Peshawar highway. It has a boarding school for 1,500 students, a high school for 1,000 day students, and 12 affiliated smaller madrasas. It was started in 1947 by Samuel Haq's father, Maulana Abdul Haq, who was a student and teacher at Deoband. Haqqaniya offers an 8-year Master of Arts course in Islamic Studies and a PhD after an additional 2 years of study. Funded by public donations, it charges its students nothing. In February 1999, the madrasa had a staggering 15,000 applicants for some 400 new places, making it the most popular madrasa in northern Pakistan. Samuel Haq, a jovial but pious man with a tremendous sense of humour and a flowing red hennaed beard, told me that his madrasa has always kept some 400 places for Afghan students. Since 1991, 60 students are accepted from Tajikistan, Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, who tend to belong to the Islamic opposition in these countries and enter Pakistan without passports or visas. Haq is still bitter about how he was ignored by the ISI for so long. The ISI always supported Hikmetyar and Qazi Hussein Ahmed, leader of the Jamaat-e-Islami, while we were ignored, even though 80% of the commanders fighting the Russians in the Pashtun areas had studied at Hakania. He told me as we sat on a rough carpet in his office, surrounded by bearded students holding application forms for the class of 99. Hikmetyar had 5% of the popular support, but 90% of the military aid from the ISI. We were never recognised. But with the arrival of the Taliban, the support of the people of Afghanistan fell into our lap, he added with a big laugh. Before 1994, I did not know Mullah Omar, because he'd not studied in Pakistan, but those around him were all Haqqaniya students and came to see me frequently to discuss what to do. I advised them not to set up a party, because the ISI was still trying to play one Mujahideen party against the other in order to keep them divided. I told them to start a student movement. When the Taliban movement began, I told the ISI, let the students take over Afghanistan, Haq said. Samuel Haq has deep respect for Mullah Omar. I met Omar for the first time when I went to Kandahar in 1996, and I was proud that he was chosen as Amir ul-Mominin. He has no money, tribe, or pedigree, but he is revered above all others, and so Allah chose him to be their leader. According to Islam, the man who can bring peace can be elected the Amir. When the Islamic Revolution comes to Pakistan, it will not be led by the old defunct leaders like me, but by a similar unknown man who will arise from the masses. Samuel Haq is in constant touch with Omar, helps him deal with international relations, and offers advice on important Sharia decisions. He is also the principal organizer for recruiting Pakistani students to fight for the Taliban. After the Taliban defeat in Mazar in 1997, he received a telephone call from Omar asking for help. Haq shut down his madrasa and sent his entire student body to fight alongside the Taliban. And after the battle for Mazar in 1988, Haq organized a meeting between Taliban leaders and 12 madrasas in the Northwest Frontier Province to organize reinforcements for the Taliban army. All the madrasas agreed to shut down for 1 month and send 8,000 students to Afghanistan. The help the Taliban receive from Pakistan's Deobandi madrasas is an important level of support they can rely on, quite apart from the government and the intelligence agencies. Another JUI faction runs the Jamiat ul-Ulumi Islamia in Binori town, a suburb of Karachi. It was established by the late Malvi Mohammed Yusuf Binori and has 8,000 students, including hundreds of Afghans. Several Taliban ministers have studied there. It also operates with the help of donations from Muslims in 45 countries. The funding we get is a blessing from Allah, said Mufti Jamil, a teacher. We're proud that we teach the Taliban, and we always pray for their success, as they've managed to implement strict Islamic laws, he added. Binori sent 600 students to join the Taliban in 1997. In November 1997, students from Binori went on a rampage in Karachi after three of their teachers were assassinated. They fought the police and smashed vehicles, video shops, and beat up photographers. It was the first time that Pakistan's largest and most cosmopolitan city had experienced Taliban-style unrest. Another extreme splinter faction of the JUI is the Sipah-e-Sahaba Pakistan, SSP, the most virulent anti-Shia group in Pakistan, which is supported by the Taliban. When the government launched a crackdown against the Sipah-e-Sahaba Pakistan in 1998, after hundreds of Shia had been massacred by the SSP, their leaders fled to Kabul, where they were offered sanctuary. Hundreds of SSP militants have trained at the Coast Training Camp, run by the Taliban and bin Laden, which the US hit with cruise missiles in 1998, and thousands of SSP members have fought alongside the Taliban. The JUI were to benefit immensely from their Taliban protégés. For the first time, the JUI developed international prestige and influence as a major patron of Islamic radicalism. Pakistani governments and the ISI could no longer ignore the party, nor could Saudi Arabia and the Arab Gulf states. Camps inside Afghanistan, which were used for military training and refuge for non-Afghan mujahideen, and which had earlier been run by Hikmetyar, were taken over by the Taliban and handed over to JUI groups such as the SSP. In 1996, the Taliban handed over Camp Badra near Khost, on the Pakistan-Afghanistan border to the Harkat ul-Ansar led by Fazlur Rehman Khalil. This was another JUI splinter group, known for its extreme militancy, which had sent members to fight in Afghanistan, Kashmir, Chechnya and Bosnia. The camp was attacked by US cruise missiles 2 years later. The links between the Taliban and some of the extreme Pakistani Deobandi groups are solid because of the common ground they share. Several Deobandi leaders from both sides of the border originate from the Durrani Pashtun tribes based around Kandahar and Shaman in Pakistan. The Deobandi tradition is opposed to tribal and feudal structures, from which stems the Taliban's mistrust of the tribal structure and the clan chiefs, and whom the Taliban have eliminated from any leadership role. Both are united in their vehement opposition to the Shia sect and Iran. Now Pakistani Deobandis want a Taliban-style Islamic revolution in Pakistan. The Taliban have clearly debased the Deobandi tradition of learning and reform with their rigidity, accepting no concept of doubt except as sin, and considering debate as little more than heresy. But in doing so, they have advanced a new, radical, and to the governments of the region extremely threatening model for any forthcoming Islamic revolution. Hikmet Yar and Massoud are not opposed to modernism. In contrast, the Taliban are vehemently opposed to modernism and have no desire to understand or adopt modern ideas of progress or economic development. The Taliban are poorly tutored in Islamic and Afghan history, knowledge of the Sharia and the Quran, and the political and theoretical developments in the Muslim world during the 20th century. While Islamic radicalism in the 20th century has a long history of scholarly writing and debate, the Taliban have no such historical perspective or tradition. There is no Taliban Islamic manifesto or scholarly analysis of Islamic or Afghan history. Their exposure to the radical Islamic debate around the world is minimal. Their sense of their own history is even less. This has created an obscurantism which allows no room for debate even with fellow Muslims. The Taliban's new model for a purist Islamic revolution has created immense repercussions in Pakistan and to a more limited extent in the Central Asian republics. Pakistan, an already fragile state beset by an identity crisis, an economic meltdown, ethnic and sectarian divisions, and a rapacious ruling elite that has been unable to provide good governance, now faces the spectre of a new Islamic wave, led not by the older, more mature and accommodating Islamic parties, but by neo-Taliban groups. By 1998, Pakistani Taliban groups were banning TV and videos in towns along the Pashtun belt, imposing Sharia punishments such as stoning and amputation in defiance of the legal system, killing Pakistani Shia, and forcing people, particularly women, to adapt to the Taliban dress code and way of life. Pakistan's support for the Taliban is thus coming back to haunt the country itself, even as Pakistani leaders appear to be oblivious of the challenge and continue to support the Taliban. In Central Asia, particularly Tajikistan and Uzbekistan, neo-Taliban militants are being hunted by the police in the Fergana Valley, which borders both countries. The Taliban and their supporters present the Muslim world and the West with a new style of Islamic extremism which rejects all accommodation with Muslim moderation and the West. The Taliban's refusal to compromise with the UN humanitarian agencies or foreign donor countries, or to compromise their principles in exchange for international recognition, and their rejection of all Muslim ruling elites as corrupt, has inflamed the debate in the Muslim world and inspired a younger generation of Islamic militants. The Taliban had given Islamic fundamentalism a new face and a new identity for the next millennium, one that refuses to accept any compromise or political system except their own. Chapter 7. Secret Society, the Taliban's political and military organization. If there was a single inspiration and hope for peace amongst ordinary Afghans after the Taliban emerged, it was the fact that they governed through a collective political leadership, which was consultative and consensus-building rather than dominated by one individual. The Taliban Shura in Kandahar claimed it was following the early Islamic model, where discussion was followed by a consensus amongst the believers, and sensitivity and accessibility to the public were deemed important. The Shura model was also heavily based on the Pashtun tribal jirga, or council, where all clan chiefs took part in deciding upon important issues which the tribe faced. On my early visits to Kandahar, I was impressed with the debates, which sometimes went on all night, as commanders, mullahs and ordinary fighters were called in to give their views before Mullah Omar took a decision. Many Afghans were also impressed by the fact that initially the Taliban did not demand power for themselves. Instead, they insisted they were restoring law and order, only to hand over power to a government which was made up of good Muslims. However, between 1994 and the capture of Kabul in 1996, the Taliban's decision-making process was to change and become highly centralized, secretive, dictatorial, and inaccessible. As Mullah Omar became more powerful and introverted, declining to travel to see and understand the rest of the country and meet the people under his control, the movement's power structure developed all the faults of the Mujahideen and communist predecessors. Moreover, after 1996, the Taliban made known their desire to become the sole rulers of Afghanistan without the participation of other groups. They maintained that the ethnic diversity of the country was sufficiently represented in the Taliban movement itself, and they set out to conquer the rest of the country to prove it. The initial hopes generated by the Taliban were a direct result of the degeneration of the former Mujahideen leadership. During the jihad, the Mujahideen leadership based in Peshawar was highly factionalized and personalized. The parties were held together by charismatic leaders and warlords rather than an organization. As the war progressed, these leaders became more and more dependent on Western-supplied funds and arms to keep their field commanders and guerrilla fighters loyal. They spent much of their time literally buying support inside Afghanistan while bickering with each other in Peshawar. Pakistan only helped fuel this process of disunity. General Zia-ul-Haq had commanded Pakistani troops in Jordan in 1970 and had helped King Hussein crush the Palestinians. He had seen at first hand the threat that a united guerrilla movement posed to the state where it had been given sanctuary. By maintaining a disunited movement with no single leader, Zia was able to keep the Mujahideen leaders obligated to Pakistan and Western largesse. But when Islamabad desperately needed a coherent Mujahideen leadership to present a political alternative to the communist regime in Kabul in 1989 as Soviet troops withdrew, and again in 1992 as the Najibullah regime collapsed, the disunity amongst the Peshawar-based Mujahideen leaders was too far gone to mend, even with significant bribes. This disunity was to have a profound effect on Afghanistan's future inability to achieve a consensus government. The second element in the anti-Soviet resistance leadership were the field commanders, who became increasingly frustrated by the disunity and corruption of the Peshawar leaders and the ease with which they were held hostage over funds and weapons supplies. The very nature and hardship of the war demanded that they cooperate with each other, despite the feuding of their party chiefs in Peshawar. There was a passionate desire for greater structural unity among the field commanders. Ismail Khan organized the first meeting of field commanders in Gore province in July 1987, which was attended by some 1,200 commanders from across Afghanistan. They adopted 20 resolutions, of which the most important was the demand that they, rather than the Peshawar leaders, dictate the political movement. The right of determining the future destiny of Afghanistan lies with the heirs of the martyrs and with the Muslims of the trenches, who are struggling in bloody fronts and are ready to be martyred. Nobody else is allowed to make decisions determining the fate of the nation. Some 300 commanders met again in Paktia province in July 1990 and in Badakhshan in October. However, ethnicity, personal rivalries, and the urge to be the first into Kabul broke down their consensus as the Mujahideen competed to seize the capital in 1992. The battle for Kabul brought the divisions between North and South and Pashtuns and non-Pashtuns into the open. Ahmad Shah Massoud's inability to compromise with Pashtun commanders opposed to Hikmatyar, even as Massoud seized Kabul in 1992, badly dented his political reputation. He was never to regain the trust of Pashtuns until after the Taliban had conquered the north in 1998. A third level of leadership within the resistance were the scholars, intellectuals, businessmen, and technocrats who had escaped from Kabul to Peshawar. Many remained independent, advocating unity amongst all the resistance forces. But this group of educated Afghans was never given a serious political role by the Peshawar parties, nor by Pakistan. As a consequence, many left Peshawar for foreign countries, adding to the diaspora of Afghan professionals. They became marginal in influencing political events at home, and when they were needed after 1992 to help rebuild the country, they were not available. The Pashtun ulema and madrasa teachers were scattered throughout the resistance movement, some as party leaders in Peshawar, others as field commanders, but they formed no united powerful presence within the resistance, and even their individual influence had waned considerably by 1992. The ulema were ripe to be taken over by a Taliban-style movement. When the Taliban emerged in 1994, only the old, bickering resistance leadership was left, and President Burhanuddin Rabbani had failed to unite them. In the Pashtun areas, there was a total vacuum of leadership as warlordism gripped the south. The Taliban rightly considered the former Mujahideen leaders as redundant and corrupt. Although the Taliban revered some leaders from the ulema, who were their earlier mentors, they gave them no political role in their movement. Nor did the Taliban have any liking for the independent-minded field commanders, whom they blamed for the debacle of the Pashtuns after 1992. Important field commanders who surrendered to the Taliban were never elevated within the Taliban military structure. The Taliban also completely rejected Afghan intellectuals and technocrats, as they considered them the spawn of a Western or Soviet-style educational system which they detested. The Taliban's emergence thus coincided with a fortunate historical juxtaposition, where the disintegration of the communist power structure was complete, the Mujahideen leaders were discredited, and the traditional tribal leadership had been eliminated. It was relatively easy for the Taliban to sweep away what little of the old Pashtun leadership was left. Thereafter, from within the Pashtuns, the Taliban faced no possible political challenges to their rule. They now had the opportunity to build a more tribal democratic grassroots organization. Imbued with the legitimizing factor of Islam, it could have responded to the population's needs, but the Taliban proved incapable and unwilling to do this. At the same time, they refused to evolve a mechanism by which they could include the representatives of the non-Pashtun ethnic groups. Their supreme position in the Pashtun areas could not be duplicated in the north unless they had the flexibility to unite the complex mosaic of the Afghan nation under a new style of collective leadership. Instead, what the Taliban ultimately created was a secret society run mainly by Kandaharis, and as mysterious, secretive, and dictatorial in its ways as the Khmer Rouge of Cambodia or Saddam Hussein's Iraq. The Taliban's apex decision-making body was the Supreme Shura, which continued to be based in Kandahar, a city which Mullah Omar has left only once to visit Kabul in 1996, and which he turned into the new power centre for Afghanistan. The Shura was dominated by Omar's original friends and colleagues, mainly Durrani Pashtuns, who came to be called the Kandaharis, even though they hailed from the three provinces of Kandahar, Helmand and Uruzgan. The original Shura was made up of 10 members, but military commanders, tribal elders and ulema took part in Shura meetings, so that it remained loose and amorphous, with as many as 50 people often taking part. Of the 10 original Shura members, 6 were Durrani Pashtuns, and only one, Malvi Syed Ghiyasuddin, was a Tajik from Badakhshan. He'd lived for a long time within the Pashtun belt. This was sufficient as long as the Taliban were advancing in the Pashtun belt, but after the capture of Herat and Kabul, the Shura became totally unrepresentative. The Kandahar Shura never broadened its base sufficiently to include Gilzai Pashtuns or non-Pashtuns. It has remained narrowly based and narrowly focused, unable to represent the interests of the entire nation. Two other shuras report to the Kandahar Shura. The first is the Cabinet of Acting Ministers in Kabul, or the Kabul Shura. The second is the Military Council, or Military Shura. Out of 17 members in the Kabul Shura in 1998, at least 8 were Durranis, while 3 are Gilzais, and only 2 were non-Pashtuns. The Kabul Shura deals with the day-to-day problems of the government, the city, and the Kabul military front, but important decisions are conveyed to the Kandahar Shura, where decisions are actually taken. Even minor decisions taken by the Kabul Shura and its chief, Mullah Mohammad Rabbani, such as permission for journalists to travel or new UN aid projects, have been frequently revoked by the Kandahar Shura. It soon became impossible for the Kabul Shura, which acted as the government of Afghanistan, to take any decision without lengthy consultations with Kandahar, delaying decisions interminably. In Kabul and Herat, and later in Mazar, none of which have a Pashtun majority, the Taliban's representatives, such as the governor, mayor, police chiefs, and other senior administrators, are invariably Kandahari Pashtuns who either do not speak Dari, the lingua franca of these cities, or speak it poorly. There is no prominent local citizen in any of these local shuras. The only flexibility the Taliban have demonstrated is in their appointments of governors to the provinces. Of 11 governors in 1998, only 4 were known to be Kandaharis. In the past, the governors and senior local officials were usually drawn from the local elite, reflecting the local ethnic makeup of the population. The Taliban broke with this tradition and appointed outsiders. However, the political powers of the Taliban governors have been considerably reduced. The paucity of funds at their disposal, their inability to carry out serious economic development or rehabilitate refugees returning from Pakistan and Iran, gave governors even less of a political, economic or social role. Mullah Omar has also kept the governors under control and not allowed them to build up a local power base. He's constantly shifted them around and sent them back to the battlefront as commanders. After the Mazar defeat in 1997, there was growing criticism from Gilzai Pashtun commanders that they were not being consulted on military and political issues, despite the fact that they now provided the bulk of the military manpower. In Mazar, the Taliban lost some 3,000 of their best troops, 3,600 were taken prisoner, and 10 leaders were killed or captured. Thus, the Taliban were forced to draw upon new recruits from the Gilzai tribes of eastern Afghanistan, but the Taliban were not prepared to yield them political power or include them in the Kandahar Shura. Increasingly, the Gilzais were not prepared to accept being used as cannon fodder by the Taliban and resisted recruitment. The military structure of the Taliban is shrouded in even greater secrecy. The head of the armed forces is Mullah Omar, although there is no actual definition of his position or his role. Under Omar there is a chief of general staff, and then chiefs of staff for the army and air force. There are at least 4 army divisions and an armoured division based in Kabul. However, there is no clear military structure with a hierarchy of officers and commanders, while unit commanders are constantly being shifted around. For example, the Taliban's Kunduz Expeditionary Force, which was the only military group in the north after the 1997 Mazar debacle, saw at least 3 changes of command in 3 months, while more than half the troops were withdrawn and flown to the Herat front and replaced by less experienced Pakistani and Afghan fighters. The military shura is a loose body which plans strategy and can implement tactical decisions, but appears to have no strategic decision-making powers. Military strategy, key appointments, and the allocation of funds for offensives are decided upon by Omar. Apart from the general conscription enforced by the Taliban, individual commanders from specific Pashtun areas are responsible for recruiting men, paying them, and looking after their needs in the field. They acquire the resources to do so, money, fuel, food, transport, weapons, and ammunition, from the military shura. There is a constant coming and going as family members change places at the front, allowing soldiers to go home for long spells. The regular Taliban army has never numbered more than 25,000 to 30,000 men, although these numbers could be rapidly increased before new offensives. At the same time, Pakistani madrasa students, who by 1999 made up some 30% of the Taliban's military manpower, also served for short periods before returning home and sending back fresh recruits. Nevertheless, this haphazard style of enlistment, which contrasted sharply with Massoud's 12,000 to 15,000 regular troops, does not allow for a regular or disciplined army to be created. As such, the Taliban fighters resemble a Lashkar, or traditional tribal militia force, which has long historical antecedents among the Pashtun tribes. A Lashkar has always been quickly mobilized, either on orders of the monarch or to defend a tribal area and fight a local feud. Those who joined a Lashkar were strictly volunteers, who were not paid salaries but shared in any loot captured from the enemy. However, Taliban troops were forbidden from looting, and in the early period they were remarkably disciplined when they occupied new towns, although this broke down after the 1997 Mazar defeat. The majority of Taliban fighters are not paid salaries, and it is up to the commander to pay his men an adequate sum of money when they go on home leave. Those who are paid regular salaries are the professional and trained soldiers drawn from the former communist army. These Pashtun tank drivers, gunners, pilots and mechanics are fighting more as mercenaries, having served in the armies of whoever controls Kabul. Several members of the military shura are also acting ministers, creating even greater chaos in the Kabul administration. Thus, Mullah Mohammed Abbas, the health minister, was the second in command of the Taliban expeditionary force trapped in the north after the 1997 Mazar defeat. He was then pulled out and sent to Herat to organise another offensive, and finally returned to his job as minister 6 months later, leaving UN aid agencies whom he was dealing with in consternation. Mullah Ehsanullah Ehsan, the governor of the state bank, commanded an elite force of some 1,000 Kandaharis, ensuring his financial job received little attention before he was killed in Mazar in 1997. Mullah Abdul Razak, the governor of Herat, was captured in Mazar in 1997 and later freed, has been leading military offensives all over the country since 1994. Almost all the members of the Kandahar and Kabul Shura, except for those with physical disabilities, have acted as military commanders at some time or the other. In one sense, this allows for remarkable flexibility amongst the Taliban hierarchy, as they all act both as administrators and generals, and this keeps them in touch with their fighters. However, the Taliban administration, especially in Kabul, has suffered enormously. While a minister is away at the front, no decisions can be taken in the ministry. The system ensured that no Taliban minister became proficient in his job or created a local power base through patronage. Mullah Omar would send any minister who was becoming too politically powerful back to the front at a moment's notice. But the result of this confusion was a country without a government and a movement without clearly defined leadership roles. The Taliban's excessive secrecy has been a major deterrent in winning public confidence in the cities, the foreign media, aid agencies and the international community. Even after they captured Kabul, the Taliban declined issuing any agenda on how they intended to set up a representative government or foster economic development. For the Taliban to insist upon international recognition, when there was no clearly demarcated government, only increased the international community's doubts about their ability to govern. The spokesman of the Kabul Shura, Sher Mohammad Stanakzai, a relatively suave, English-speaking Gilzai Taliban from Logar province, who'd trained in India as a policeman, was the Taliban conduit for the UN aid agencies and the foreign media. However, it quickly became apparent that Stanakzai had no real power and did not even have direct access to Mullah Omar in order to convey messages and receive an answer. As a consequence, his job became meaningless, as aid agencies never knew if their messages were even reaching Omar. The Taliban increased the confusion by purging Kabul's bureaucracy, whose lower levels had remained in place since 1992. The Taliban replaced all senior Tajik, Uzbek and Hazara bureaucrats with Pashtuns, whether qualified or not. As a result of this loss of expertise, the ministries by and large ceased to function. Within the ministries, the Taliban work ethic defied description. No matter how serious the military or political crisis, government offices in Kabul and Kandahar are open for only 4 hours a day, from 8 a.m. to noon. The Taliban then break for prayers and a long afternoon siesta. Later, they have long social gatherings or meetings at night. Ministers' desks are empty of files, and government offices are empty of the public. Thus, while hundreds of Taliban cadres and bureaucrats were involved in a drive to force the male population to grow long beards, nobody was available to answer queries in the ministries. The public ceased to expect anything of the ministries, while the lack of local representation in urban administrations made the Taliban appear as an occupying force rather than administrators trying to win hearts and minds. The Taliban have, to date, given no indication as to how and when they would set up a more permanent representative government, whether they would have a constitution or not, and how political power would be divided. Every Taliban leader has different views on the subject. The Taliban are willing to negotiate with the opposition, but on the one condition that no political parties take part in the discussions. Most of the Taliban have come from political parties, and we know the conflict they create. Islam is against all political parties, a minister told me. Eventually, when we have peace, people can select their own government. But first, the opposition has to be disarmed, said another minister. Others wanted an exclusive Taliban government. After 1996, power was entirely concentrated in the hands of Mullah Omar, while the Kandahar Shura was consulted less and less. Mullah Omar's confidant, Wakil, made this apparent. Decisions are based on the advice of the Amir al-Mu'mineen. For us, consultation is not necessary. We believe that this is in line with the Sharia. We abide by the Amir's view, even if he alone takes this view. There will not be a head of state. Instead, there will be an Amir ul-Mu'mineen. Mullah Omar will be the highest authority, and the government will not be able to implement any decision to which he does not agree. General elections are incompatible with Sharia, and therefore we reject them. To implement his decisions, Mullah Omar relied less on the Kabul government and increasingly upon the Kandahari ulema and the religious police in Kabul. Maulvi Saeed Mohammed Passanai, the Chief Justice of Kandahar's Islamic Supreme Court, who had taught Omar the basics of Sharia law during the jihad, became a key advisor to Omar. He claimed responsibility for ending lawlessness in the country through Islamic punishments. We have judges presiding over 13 high courts in 13 provinces, and everywhere there is peace and security for the people, he told me in 1997. Passanai, who is in his 80s, said that he had handed out Islamic punishments for nearly half a century in local villages and guided the Mujahideen in applying Sharia during the jihad. The Kandahar Islamic Supreme Court became the most important court in the country because of its proximity to Omar. The court appointed Islamic judges, qazis, and assistant qazis in the provinces, and once or twice a year assembled them all in Kandahar to discuss cases and the application of Sharia law. A parallel system exists in Kabul, where the Justice Ministry and the Supreme Court of Afghanistan are based. The Kabul Supreme Court handles about 40 cases a week and comprises 8 departments which deal with laws related to commerce, business, criminal and public law, but it clearly does not have the same powers as the Kandahar Supreme Court. According to Attorney General Maulvi Jalilullah Maulvizadeh, all the laws are being Islamicized. Those laws repugnant to Islam are being removed. It will take several years for us to go through all the old laws and change or remove them. The worsening economic situation and political alienation in Taliban-controlled areas, along with the massive military losses they suffered, led to increasing internal divisions. In January 1997, the Taliban faced a revolt from within the Kandahar heartland over forced conscription. At least 4 Taliban recruiters were killed by villagers who refused to join the army. The Taliban were driven out from several villages around Kandahar after gunfights in which there were casualties on both sides. Village elders said that their young men faced death if they joined the army. The Taliban had promised peace. Instead, they've given us nothing but war. said one village elder. In June, the Taliban executed 18 army deserters in Kandahar jail. There were similar movements against conscription in Wardak and Paktia provinces. Forced conscription has increased the Taliban's unpopularity and forced them to draw more upon recruits from Pakistani madrasas and Afghan refugees settled there. Meanwhile, the simmering differences between the Shuras in Kandahar and Kabul escalated dramatically in April 1998 after the visit of the US envoy Bill Richardson to Kabul. Mullah Rabbani, the head of the Kabul Shura, agreed to implement Richardson's point agenda, but the next day the agreement was rejected by Mullah Omar from Kandahar. Rabbani went off on one of his periodic long leaves, and there were rumours he was under arrest. In October 1998, the Taliban arrested over 60 people in Jalalabad, the largest city in eastern Afghanistan, claiming there was a coup attempt by ex-military officers loyal to General Shahnawaz Tanai, the Pashtun general who in 1990 had deserted Najibullah's army and joined the Mujahideen. His Pashtun officers had supported the Taliban since 1994, and many served in the Taliban army. In December, the Taliban shot a student dead and wounded several others during a disturbance at the medical faculty of Nangarhar University in Jalalabad. Strikes and anti-Taliban protests took place in the city. The growing discontent in Jalalabad appeared to be instigated by supporters of the more moderate Mullah Rabbani, who had built a political base in the city. Jalalabad's powerful traders, who ran the smuggling trade from Pakistan, also wanted a more liberal attitude from the Taliban. After the Jalalabad incidents, Mullah Rabbani was once again recalled from Kabul to Kandahar and disappeared from view for several months. By 1998, the Kabul Shura was keen to moderate Taliban policies so that UN agencies could return to Afghanistan and greater international aid flow to the cities. Taliban leaders in the Kabul and Jalalabad Shuras were feeling the growing public discontent at rising prices, lack of food, and the cutback in humanitarian aid. However, Mullah Omar and the Kandahar leadership refused to allow an expansion of UN aid activities and eventually forced the UN to quit. In the winter of 1998 to 99, there were several acts of looting and robbery by Taliban soldiers, reflecting the growing indiscipline caused by economic hardship. In the worst such incident, in Kabul in January 1999, six Taliban soldiers had their right arms and left feet amputated for looting. The authorities then hung the amputated limbs from trees in the city centre, where they could be seen by the public until they rotted. Although internal differences increased speculation about serious weakness within the Taliban, which could lead to an intra-Taliban civil war, Mullah Omar's exalted position and increased powers allowed him to keep total control of the movement. Thus, the Taliban, like the Mujahideen before them, had resorted to one-man rule with no organisational mechanism to accommodate other ethnic groups or points of view. The struggle between moderate and hardline Taliban went underground, with no Taliban leader willing to contradict Omar or oppose him. Such a situation is more than likely to lead to an eventual explosion within the Taliban, an intra-Taliban civil war, which can only once again divide the Pashtuns and bring more suffering to the common people. Chapter 8. A Vanished Gender. Women, Children and Taliban Culture. Nobody ever wants to see the inside of Maulvi Kalamuddin's sparse office in the centre of Kabul. Half the population never will, anyway, because the Maulvi does not allow women to even enter the building. A huge Pashtun tribesman, with enormous feet and hands, a long, thick nose, black eyes and a bushy black beard that touches his desk while he talks, Kalamuddin's physique and name generate fear across the city. As head of the Taliban's religious police, the stream of regulations he issues from this office has dramatically changed the lifestyle of Kabul's once easygoing population and forced Afghan women to disappear entirely from public view. Maulvi Kalamuddin runs the Amar Bil Maruf Wa Nahi An Al Munkar, or the Department of the Promotion of Virtue and Prevention of Vice. He himself prefers the translation as Department of Religious Observances. In the streets, people just call the department's thousands of young zealots, who walk around with whips, long sticks and kalashnikovs, the religious police, and even more derogatory names. The day I visited him for a rare interview in the summer of 1997, he had just issued new regulations which banned women from wearing high heels, making a noise with their shoes while they walked, or wearing makeup. Stylish dress and decoration of women in hospitals is forbidden. Women are duty-bound to behave with dignity, to walk calmly, and refrain from hitting their shoes on the ground, which makes noises, the edict read. How the zealots could even see women's makeup or their shoes, considering that all women were now garbed in the head-to-toe burqa, was mystifying. The new edict formalized previous restrictions on disallowing women from working, but it now also banned them from working for Western humanitarian aid agencies, except in the medical sector. Women are not allowed to work in any field except the medical sector. Women working in the medical sector should not sit in the seat next to the driver. No Afghan woman has the right to be transported in the same car as foreigners, the edict continued. Education for boys is also at a standstill in Kabul because most of the teachers are women who now cannot work. An entire generation of Afghan children are growing up without any education. Thousands of educated families have fled Kabul for Pakistan simply because their children can no longer receive an education. I nervously asked Kalamuddin what justified the Taliban's ban on women from working and going to school. "We will be blamed by our people if we don't educate women, and we will provide education for them eventually, but for now we have serious problems," he replied. Like so many mullahs, and despite his size, he is surprisingly soft-spoken, and I strain to catch his words. "There are security problems. There are no provisions for separate transport, separate school buildings and facilities to educate women for the moment. Women must be completely segregated from men. And within us we have those men who cannot behave properly with women. We lost 2 million people in the war against the Soviets because we had no Sharia law. We fought for Sharia, and now this is the organization that will implement it. I will implement it, come what may," Kalamuddin said emphatically. When the Taliban first entered Kabul, the religious police beat men and women in public for not having long enough beards or not wearing the burqa properly. "We advise our staff not to beat people on the streets. We only advise people how to behave according to the Sharia. For example, if a person is about to reverse his car into another car, then we just warn you not to reverse now," Kalamuddin said with a broad grin on his face, obviously pleased with his modern metaphor. The department is modelled on a similar government organisation in Saudi Arabia, and it has recruited thousands of young men, many of them with only a minimum madrasa education, from Pakistan. The department is also the Taliban's most effective intelligence agency, a bizarre throwback to KHAD, the enormous intelligence agency run by the communist regime in the 1980s. KHAD, which later changed its name to WAD, employed 15,000 to 30,000 professional spies, as well as having 100,000 paid informers. Kalamuddin admitted that he has thousands of informers in the army, government ministries, hospitals, and Western aid agencies. "Our staff all have experience in religious issues, and we are an independent organization, and we don't take advice from the Justice Ministry or the Supreme Court as to what we should implement. We obey the orders of the Amir Mullah Muhammad Omar." Kalamuddin's edicts are broadcast regularly on Radio Shariat, formerly Radio Kabul, and cover every aspect of social behaviour for the population. One addresses public attendance at sports events, which the Taliban had initially banned. All onlookers, while encouraging the sportsmen, are asked to chant "Allah O Akbar," God is great, and refrain from clapping. In case the game coincides with prayer time, the game should be interrupted. Both the players and spectators should offer prayers in congregation, said the edict. Kite flying, once a favourite pastime in the spring for Kabulis, is still banned, as are all sports for women. For the Taliban, anyone questioning these edicts, which have no validity in the Quran, is tantamount to questioning Islam itself, even though the Prophet Muhammad's first task was to emancipate women. The supreme, unmistakable test of Islam was the emancipation of women, first beginning to be proclaimed, then more slowly on the way to being achieved, said Ferdinand Braudel. But the Taliban did not allow even Muslim reporters to question these edicts or to discuss interpretations of the Quran. To foreign aid workers, they simply said, "You are not Muslim, so you have no right to discuss Islam." The Taliban were right, their interpretation of Islam was right, and everything else was wrong and an expression of human weakness and a lack of piety. "The constitution is the Sharia, so we don't need a constitution. People love Islam, and that is why they all support the Taliban and appreciate what we are doing," said Attorney General Mauvli Jalilullah Malvizada. However, the plight of Afghan women and Afghan society as a whole began well before the Taliban arrived. 20 years of continuous warfare has destroyed Afghan civil society, the clan community and family structure, which provided an important cushion of relief in an otherwise harsh economic landscape. Afghanistan has one of the lowest rated indices for the human condition in the world. The infant mortality rate is 163 deaths per 1,000 births, 18%, the highest in the world, which compares to an average of 70 per 1,000 in other developing countries. A quarter of all children die before they reach their fifth birthday, compared to one-tenth that number in developing countries. A staggering 1,700 mothers out of 100,000 die giving birth. Life expectancy for men and women is just 43 to 44 years old, compared to 61 years for people in other developing countries. Only 29% of the population has access to health, and 12% has access to safe water, compared to 80% and 70% respectively in developing states. Children die of simple preventable diseases like measles and diarrhea because there are no health facilities and no clean water. Illiteracy was a major problem before the Taliban appeared, affecting 90% of girls and 60% of boys. There were huge swaths of rural Afghanistan where schools had been destroyed in the war and not a single one remained. Thus, the Taliban's gender policies only worsened an ongoing crisis. Within 3 months of the capture of Kabul, the Taliban closed 63 schools in the city, affecting 103,000 girls, 148,000 boys, and 11,200 teachers, of whom 7,800 were women. They shut down Kabul University, sending home some 10,000 students, of which 4,000 were women. By December 1998, UNICEF reported that the country's educational system was in a state of total collapse, with 9 in 10 girls and 2 in 3 boys not enrolled in school. The Afghan people's desperate plight was largely ignored by the outside world. Whereas in the 1980s the war in Afghanistan attracted attention and aid, the moment the Soviets withdrew their troops in 1989, Afghanistan dropped off the radar screen of world attention. The ever-dwindling aid from wealthy donor countries, which did not even meet the minimum budgetary requirements of the humanitarian aid effort, became a scandal. In 1996, the UN had requested $124 million for its annual humanitarian aid program to Afghanistan, but by the end of the year it had only received $65 million. In 1997, it asked for $133 million and received only $56 million, or 42%. And the following year, it asked for $157 million but received only $53 million, or 34%. By 1999, the UN had drastically scaled down its request to just $113 million. In the words of scholar Barnett Rubin, "If the situation in Afghanistan is ugly today, it is not because the people of Afghanistan are ugly. Afghanistan is not only the mirror of the Afghans, it is the mirror of the world. If you do not like the image in the mirror, do not break the mirror, break your face," says an old Persian proverb.